Our next guest explores civil disobedience in the United States and says it's a central theme in American history.
Lewis Perry joins us now. He's professor emeritus of history at St. Louis University. He's the author of Civil Disobedience and American Tradition. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So first, as I was looking at your book, I realized that in my brain I was blurring concepts together. Civil disobedience, protest, passive resistance. I want to get you, first of all, to define civil disobedience in particular and what you mean by it.
Yeah, there are other kinds of protests and methods of protest, but civil disobedience is a phrase that has come to describe a certain, at least a group of actions that people take where they disobey a law in order to protest, usually that law itself, but maybe something else larger, and usually, but not always, are ready to accept the punishment or some punishment afterwards, but that gets controversial sometime within the tradition. I do think it is a tradition that has been going on for a long time in the United States and in some other places, maybe not so long, but it is an interesting tradition in American history, in the history of American social movements, protest movements.
Well, it's probably not uniquely an American tradition. Is it, I guess, particularly American, this concept of civil disobedience?
I think it is, and actually the first person who described it as an American tradition and that no other country had anything quite like it was the philosopher Hannah Arendt in 1970. But not too many people have picked up on that, but it really hit me when I read her remarks, because that's what I was trying to understand, and it seems to me it does fit this long category of actions.
We'll talk about specific examples over the years, but why do you think that this was such an American thing, an American tradition that isn't equaled elsewhere? What is it about us?
I think it has something to do with the way in which the Constitution was created. It is first of all a nation that has a different history from some others. In any case, in the way it was founded, there was virtually no willingness to accept disobedience to laws in the Constitutional Convention. Of course, there was lots of disobedience in society, but no room left for a disobedient protest. And so, I think the means that was open to some people was to protest and then to go through a process of being in jail, if that's what the punishment is, and then protesting that. But it has to do with American constitutional life, I think.
And I don't want to hammer away too much the definition, but is nonviolence an inherent part of what we're talking about when we talk about civil disobedience?
Almost inherent, not quite. It traditionally was, but especially in more recent times, there have been some people who certainly associate themselves with the civil disobedience tradition, but do not feel they have to accept a code of nonviolence. But if the action is not nonviolent, it won't go over in the same way, and it won't be recognized by other people who believe in civil disobedience and nonviolence as in the right vein to make a protest in the United States.
Well, let's crack.
There's also a long history of violent protests.
Well, yes, that can be a sequel.
Yeah.
So let's crack into the history a little. Where do you see the first examples of civil disobedience here in the United States?
There are almost none really in the colonial period, because there's no colonial nation. There's no nation at that moment. But there are various protests in different colonies, mostly for religious rights, for rights for religious minorities. Almost all the colonies had established churches, and the Baptists, whom I discuss in Rhode Island on the eve of the Revolution, were putting together something very much like what later became civil disobedience. But then the Revolution began, and they didn't go forward with that. The protests that I credit with being really the origin of civil disobedience were protests on behalf of the Cherokees and other Indian tribes but especially the Cherokees, by a lawyer and missionaries from the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, a Protestant group that was related to the a lot of other Protestant reform movements, and they worked out an action where a number of missionaries at first, but two of them for a longer period of time actually were in jail, took it to a Supreme Court case with John Marshall, which was never clearly resolved, but they stayed in jail for until they were released, and then went with the Cherokees to the west when they did get removed. The end of the protest didn't succeed in keeping the Cherokees in their homes. But ultimately,
that was the Trail of Tears under Andrew Jackson.
Yes, that's right. The Supreme Court decision that they won, it's very complicated, but it ended up being valuable in the mid-20th century to lawyers who were working with American Indians more recently. So that they did win something, but that they couldn't see themselves that turned out to be a valuable, useful precedent.
And what
that's where I see it begins. And then after that, it's very much in the slavery controversy. I credit first of all escaping slaves, some of them, and some who didn't escape with civil disobedience in some cases. Certainly the ones that wrote, there were a couple of actually there are a lot of books that were written by escaping slaves, and in describing what they had done, they frequently mapped out something that became civil disobedience. And then in the North, there was a lot of what we would clearly call civil disobedience by slaves who were no longer slaves because they had escaped and were in the North and part of Northern society. But that's how I see it beginning. Mm-hmm.
Is a part of civil disobedience, it seems, is maybe this demeans it, but a public relations mission convincing other people that this is a cause, first of all, and that something needs to change. Did, say, the escaped slaves who were doing civil disobedience, the people in the North, the abolitionists, did they change how people were thinking about slavery in the run-up to the Civil War?
Oh, they must have. But I think they're different, though. The abolitionist movements in the United States include both escaped slaves and other black people who had not been enslaved, and various kinds of white reformers. They have slightly different approaches. I would say that in general, but not always, the black abolitionists were not as committed to nonviolence. They were nonviolent, but they were not as they were uneasy with the description of that stance as anything more than a means to try and achieve ends. But that's really where civil disobedience becomes common in American society, is in the abolitionist movement. It then is adopted in a number of other movements. But I devote a lot of attention to anti-slavery.
And one of the next, jumping ahead a bit here, but one of the next big movements that you cite as relying on civil disobedience is the women's suffrage movement. What kind of tactics of civil disobedience did we see there?
Well, a lot of the women who were active and the lawyers who and men who supported them had been abolitionists, and the tactics that they use are. First of all, there's a whole series. It may seem unusual to think about it today, but sort of illegal voting. It was in some states, including the state where I live in Missouri, and it was easier to go into a government office and vote, even if you're not legally a citizen. I mean, if you could persuade the people looking over the ballots, and there are a number of kind of illegal votings like that, including the most famous one was Susan B. Anthony, who then got tried for illegal voting and said, and this is what the history of civil disobedience as a tradition is like, that well, I'm doing this, and it's just like what we all did when there were fugitive slaves that needed to be helped along. It was illegal, but we did it because it was right, and I'm voting because it's right, and the law will change in that case, too.
And that's kind of a core idea behind civil disobedience, that there are moral priorities, maybe moral laws, if people live in that way, that trump the laws of the land.
That's right. That's right. And always a hard case to make in a republic, which is also proud of the fact that its laws originate with the citizens and their representatives in government.
We're talking to historian Lewis Perry. His new book is Civil Disobedience, an American Tradition.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about civil disobedience? Have you participated in civil disobedience? And is it still effective today? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Marcy from Madison, Wisconsin. I donated my vehicle to Wisconsin Public Radio. I wanted it to go to a good home. I felt like I didn't want to retire it completely. I wanted it to do some good in the world and to my station. It just made sense, and it was easy, and they came and picked it up. I continue to feel very good about that it's out there in the world doing good to someone else.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program.
Go to WPR.org.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include the thousands of listeners who give to WPR via ongoing monthly donations. Set up your sustaining contribution today. Your gift benefits everyone who listens. Go to WPR.org and click donate.
Escape to a simpler time when all you needed were the basics and a boat. WPR presents Return to Wake Robin, a memoir of life in the Northwoods. Get the audiobook in the radio store. Call 1-800-747-7444.
Coming up at 6 o'clock, it's 45 North, and Strange Sham's guest believes that death is the single most important conversation we can talk about at the dinner table. That's coming up at 6 o'clock tonight on 45 North.
Now here's a look at headlines with Kristen Durst.
JPMorgan Chase has agreed to pay $5.1 billion to resolve claims that it misled Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac about risky mortgage securities it sold the companies before the housing market collapsed. The securities soured after the housing bubble burst in 2007, losing billions in value. United Airlines has been slapped with a fine topping $1 million for stranding passengers on 13 planes for more than 3 hours on the tarmac. It happened on a stormy day last July at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. Toilets weren't working on two of the planes. That's the largest fine levied against an airline since 2010, when new stranding rules went into effect. MetJet's decision to end operations tomorrow is complicating travel for some passengers who booked flights through the failed DePere company. MetJet sold tickets to specific destinations and contracted with Sun Country to provide airplanes and crews. All of more news at 5:30.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We continue our conversation now with Lewis Perry about his new book, Civil Disobedience, an American Tradition. You can join in with your questions or experiences with civil disobedience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a few moments. But first, Lewis, when I think of civil disobedience, I think of the civil rights movement, and I'm guessing a lot of people do there. And it seems like that was really the perfect storm of civil disobedience. Can you talk about why that became what it was?
Well, I can say something about that, but I think there was more civil disobedience before the civil rights movement became familiar in the sit-ins and in the Montgomery bus boycott and the Freedom Ride. There was more before that than is usually remembered. I hope that part of what my book does is give a better sense of the shape of that tradition. And there are certainly people still alive today who remember civil rights protests in the 1940s, before and after World War II. The people that hadn't waited for Martin Luther King or the later beginning of what we now think of as the civil rights movement, but still it is, as you say, it became a remarkable broad, widespread movement just after the Montgomery boycott and in the decade or so after that. And it is probably true when someone today says, I'm going to, in Wisconsin or Missouri or wherever, engage in civil disobedience, that they will say it's in the spirit of Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King or those, John Lewis, perhaps the congressman who still is a very public civil disobedient. Why it got remembered that way, and the events before that are not so well remembered, I'm not sure, but I think they deserve to be, and I've tried to fill in those blanks too. The protest over a Jim Crow army during the World War II and the Korean War and protests over lunch counters, segregation, and all kinds of things in the nation's capital and other places in the late 30s and in the 1940s, what was called a March on Washington movement before Montgomery and before the later, more familiar March on Washington that we've just all commemorated.
Well, that's an interesting point that didn't just spring out of nowhere. Did the people who organized those latter civil disobedience actions that you mentioned do it consciously in the spirit of the ones you just mentioned, the suffragette movement, and going back further into the history of civil disobedience?
They did know that history, and they also they also had read in some cases or talked with people who had read books written about Gandhi and nonviolence. Gandhi popularized Gandhi didn't. I don't mean any popularizer, but he brought nonviolence to public attention in a way that was different from previous anti-war movements and peace movements, with the emphasis on facing and accepting punishment and kind of active nonviolence that can change things. And that was actually, there were a couple of books published in America and widely read in the 1930s and 40s and then afterwards that an Indian man who had come to Columbia as a graduate student, Krishnalal Sridharani, and Richard Gregg, an American who had lived in India for a while, and both of them wrote books that were passed around in the civil rights movement. In fact, when people remember it being in carrying it in their pockets and handing it from one person to another, both of those books. It may not be as well remembered, I'm not sure, but I hope it my book will restore some sense of that of the predecessors. Of course, part of the reason it history has the shape that it had is that the civil rights intentions and actions of after the Civil War and in the amendments to the Constitution had been really negated by the Supreme Court and by Southern society. So there wasn't that sense of a continuing progress across the decades. But there were always people who had a fuller sense of history. And in the end, we did have the national experience where Martin Luther King and others were able to speak about nonviolence generally and about segregation in the America they lived in, and in the history of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and the failed promises of Reconstruction.
All right, I want to get to one of our callers. We've got David in Burlington on with us now. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. This is a great topic. It's civil disobedience and the brave people that always follow through that have always been at a special place in my heart, so I'm glad we get to talk about them.
It does take courage. It does take courage.
Your question was, hello?
Yep, go ahead, David.
What I saw was back in the early 90s, the civil disobedience movement of the Christian right protesting against abortion. backfired, and it wasn't effective. Washington passed laws that made it illegal to picket and perform functions in front of abortion clinics within, was it 500 or 1,000 yards, some crazy distance.
David, we only have a few minutes left. I want to get Professor Perry to respond. Lewis, you write about the anti-abortion movement of the 90s.
It is a very important part of this tradition that I'm describing. And actually, some of the people on the Christian right had also previously had experience in the civil rights movements of the previous decades. But they sort of had reoriented themselves. But they remained committed in their view to the spirit of the abolitionists and Martin Luther King. There were others who became much more violent and tested the public acceptance and led to that amendment that was that law that was passed in the Clinton years. Partly that law showed how little appreciation there was or memory there was of how important civil disobedience had been over the decades in other struggles and other times.
Just in our last minute civil disobedience, it isn't just history. Is it still with us?
Oh, it's still with us. I joke about this, that I could barely finish my book because while I was working with copy editors and proofreaders and doing all of that, I kept a folder about things that maybe I could add to the book. Well, by that time, it got to be too late to add to the book, but I still had to think about them. And it goes on. I keep up with it every day, and just in the sense of I'm not going to have a second edition, I don't think. But Wisconsin, of course, is a very fertile ground for lots of civil disobedience right now. That and North Carolina are states where there is lots of civil disobedience right now, and I'm very interested in it. It's certainly not a tradition that is ended by any means.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lewis Perry. His new book is Civil Disobedience, an American Tradition.